Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi everyone, welcome to Lush Tums the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today, Claire and I are so excited to be joined by Millie Hill, founder of the Positive Birth Movement and author of the Positive Birth book and Give Birth Like a Feminist. Chances are, if you are pregnant or had a baby in the last 4 years, you will have read one of her books. Millie aims to educate women so that they can make the right choices for them and wants us to challenge the fear-based narrative surrounding birth. Her latest book, My Period, Find Your Flow and Feel Proud of Your Period, is aimed at girls aged 9 to 13, so that they can approach this milestone with knowledge, confidence and excitement. Welcome, Millie.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Hi, Millie. It's so lovely to meet you at last. I've been a big fan for many years.
Oh, thank you.
So we'd love to hear about your journey. Did you always want to be a writer?
Well, not really. I mean, I've always loved words and writing, and I did my degree in English literature, and you know, I used to write stuff. I've always written, but I didn't really think of becoming a book writer. I think it's something that sort of just happened slowly, really. No, I didn't. It was one of those things, I think, you know, when you become a mum, you know, you kind of have a sort of have to in some ways. It depends on what career you're already in. I was working as a therapist, which I really loved, but it was very difficult to sustain that job and have very small children and babies, because I was sort of traveling around all over the sort of Southwest, and, you know, it wasn't really very practical in terms of like childcare and everything. And also it was quite intense. You know, I was working with people post abuse, and I was working in a big rehab, and it was very, very sort of powerful, difficult stuff that, you know, I was working with a group of women who had a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. So I really was, you know, I was working in very intense environments, and it didn't really feel very compatible with parenting babies and small children either. It felt like really those two worlds really jarred with each other. So like many women, I sort of, for sort of practical reasons mainly, started to sort of try and explore different ways of using my brain and being creative and doing things that were fulfilling to me without necessarily leaving the house. And, you know, that could fit around, you know, working in the evenings and that kind of thing. So that's how I started writing. And like I said, I'd always loved words and reading and writing, but I then started a blog, which some people still remember. Some people still say, oh, I remember that. I started a blog called The Mule. I don't know if you guys ever read it. But that was just like as a fun thing, just to sort of think, I wonder what would happen if I just started writing every week. And then I made myself do it every week, so that I sort of always showed up and wrote something. And it wasn't just a blog like, you know, kind of just, oh, what, today we went to the zoo and here's some pictures kind of thing. I tried to write almost like journalistic style, or, you know, creative writing, that kind of stuff. I tried to write well with it, and it was really successful, and that's how it all started, really.
So it sounds like becoming a mum was a massively inspiring time in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a life-changing event for everybody, and, you know, in different ways. And obviously it depends how old you are when you come to it and what you're already doing with your life, but for me it was, yeah, it was really transformative and really challenging as well. I'm not trying to like glorify it in any way. I think it's really, it does kind of almost start, you have to sort of start so many things over from the beginning again. And it was difficult, but yeah, it has been really, really great in many other ways. So,
So what inspired you to write the Positive Birth book?
It's a really interesting thing, writing, I think, especially now, you know, with things like a blog, because you can you put an idea out there that you might have just had in your head, and it might just seem like a really niche thought that you had, and you get almost an immediate reaction to that. So it's quite interesting. And like I say, I had some thoughts about birth that I thought were maybe just me, but whenever I sort of shared them, I got a big response. So that was kind of how I ended up doing more and more writing about the topic of birth. And then it's just the way life leads you in certain directions. You know, I was really passionate about supporting independent midwives. So I'd, you know, blogged about what was happening to them. And then they were doing a big march on London. And I sort of thought, I'm going to be really brave and I'm going to write to someone at a big newspaper and say, I want to write about this. And I didn't have any idea how to pitch an article to editors or anything like that at that point. I'd never had any training in journalism or pitching or anything like that, but I just contacted a few different papers, and this woman from the Telegraph replied to me and said, this is really interesting, can I talk to you on the phone? And I was like, oh my god, I can still remember it. But it was one of those moments, and this has happened to me a few times now, where it lands on the desk of somebody who's pregnant. And that's what happened with Give Birth Like a Feminist as well, funnily enough. I think sometimes it's not until a woman is pregnant that she starts to plug into some of these ideas and thoughts. And I ended up writing this article for the Telegraph about the demise of independent midwifery. And that then got read by somebody else who, you know, was very interested in these issues, an amazing woman called Abigail Blackburn, who's still a really good friend of mine. And she then contacted me because she'd been made an editor of this online magazine called Best. So I ended up writing an article for that magazine about Kate Middleton, because it was kind of like a very sort of celeb-based gossip magazine. And it was, they wanted me to write about how whenever women sort of make choices around like natural birth or, you know, hypnobirthing, they always get, you know, they quite often get mocked in the press. So I wrote that article and that went really viral. So I ended up doing a column for Best magazine about birth, parenting, motherhood, breastfeeding for about 2.5 years. Every single week I wrote an article for them. To get to the point of writing a book, I think it's a long journey towards that, really. And it was years of work. You know, some of which was unpaid and just out of, well, much of it was unpaid and out of passion, really, to get to the point of writing a book. But the Positive Birth book just came from writing that column, really, for all of that time. So like I say, it was kind of like a sort of a chain of events, some of which, you know, as usual in life, some of which were just lucky coincidences of people reading things or being in the right place at the right time. That's how I ended up writing the Positive Birth book. And the Positive Birth book in itself is a really long story, because it didn't start life as the Positive Birth book with Pinter and Martin either. Shall I tell you the story?
Yes, please.
Basically, it was going to be a completely different book. I was going to do a book with someone called Beverly Turner. It was going to be a book with a different publisher, and we were going to co-author it, and it was going to be called The Happy Birth Book. Which I mean, that was one of the things that I absolutely hated, hated that title. And it's really difficult to write a book with somebody else. So then it all fell apart, you see, with her and with the publisher. And I was sat there with half a book, feeling really on the buffers, you know, just thinking, oh, I can't believe this has happened. What am I going to do now? And I already had a slight relationship with Pinter and Martin, so I contacted them and was honest about what happened and just said, I've got an idea of how I can rescue the work that I've done and make it into a book still. Will you publish it? And they said yes.
I love that, how something so brilliant can be birthed, if you like, out of disaster.
Yeah.
Maybe the book wouldn't be what it is if you hadn't had the difficulties that came before. I think that's really wonderful that the book sort of went through changes to become the brilliant thing that it became. It's such an accessible book for every person that picks it up can read it. It's so full of so much knowledge and information and it does it in a way that is not preachy, or it's not got an angle. You're not trying to convince people to do something that isn't in line with how they think and feel. All it is giving people really good information in a really accessible way that means they can make those choices and are more likely to have a positive birthing experience. So I'm sorry that that sounded like a really difficult period in your life, but also I'm not sorry because it's ended up with something wonderful being created.
Thank you. And thank you for saying all those lovely things about the book. And, you know, I do feel really positive about it now. But I mean, on the other hand, it's interesting in life how, you know, sometimes it's how things turn out that govern how you are able to reflect on the whole story. But at the time, you know, I felt really crap about it because I felt like I just lost this opportunity. You know, I did have a vision for the book that was quite specific, and I you know, it is important to me what you just said about it being, you know, for all choices. I think that's one of the things that's, you know, really important to me. There are just, there's so many positive Amazon reviews, but every so often somebody will write one that says, oh, it was too much about home birth or something. And it really bothers me because I think, oh no, I really, really wish that you hadn't felt that way about it, because I didn't want it to be that sort of book.
Yeah, we always talk about that, actually. I think that's why the Positive Birth book resonated with me personally so much, was, you know, it was so in tune with our Lush Tums ethos. And what we always kind of try and sing from the rooftops is, you know, giving people the information so they can make their informed decisions of what's best for them and their family. So for me, when I read that book, it just hit home on actually being able to hold the polarization quite well, and enable people to make their own choices. So that's why we kind of recommend it to every mum that comes through our doors. And it's on our training curriculum for anyone that trains with us. They have to read your book. It was actually the book I kind of say to all of the everyone, oh, I wish I'd written that, because this is what I was trying to articulate, because there is a difference between a positive birth and a natural birth. And I think you can talk all about natural birth and get quite biased, but the positive birth is able to hold all sorts of different kinds of ways babies are born and all different kinds of experiences women have from a much more neutral perspective.
Unfortunately, people will now use the term positive birth interchangeably with the natural birth movement, and that always makes me really cross when I hear people saying that, because it's not the same thing. And it's really important that we make that distinction, and that's clear in your book to me that it wasn't the natural birth book, it was the positive birth book.
So I guess that was one of Claire and my questions to you, is like, you know, what's your take on the difference between a positive birth and that natural birth, and how would you frame that?
Well, I think it's complicated. You're right that a lot of people sort of think positive birth means natural birth. So there's already that bias, if you like, that, you know, assumption that people have that that's what it's going to be about. But I wonder whether that assumption comes from the fact that, you know, for a lot of women, natural does equal positive, you know, and we mustn't, I think that's the thing we've got to do. So we've got to think about what women really want. We've got to think about the current, what's currently available, the current culture. So yeah, it's a complicated thing. You know, and we also, what motivates our choices. So if you say, well, for me, a positive birth would be going straight into hospital, having an epidural and, you know, just getting it done, you know, as quickly as possible kind of thing. Well, there's a, you know, what's motivating that? So it's not just as simple as saying, oh, it's whatever's right for everybody, you know, and, you know, it's such a complicated area. At the moment, birth is becoming more and more and more medicalized. And I think that is, you know, to women's detriment, really. So I think we've got to do two things. We've got to sort of focus on trying to hold on to what normal, natural, physiological birth actually means, and we've got to acknowledge that a large number of women would like that kind of birth, and that that's okay. But we've also got to ensure that women who genuinely don't want that kind of birth for whatever reason, or can't have that kind of birth for whatever reason, or don't end up having that kind of birth for whatever reason, also have a positive experience. So the baseline underneath everything is that people who are having their babies feel you know, that they are at the centre of decision making, that they're being listened to, that they're being heard, that they're being respected, and that, you know, this event is being sort of venerated, if you like, and, you know, treated as something really important, a rite of passage, a transformative life experience, you know, that they will remember for the rest of their lives. So no matter how their baby is born, how they choose to have their baby, or how it ends up being born, you know, that that's, that they are held at the centre of that and really cherished and made to feel special. That's the bottom line, really. And that's got nothing to do with whether you're in an operating theatre, a labour ward, a birth centre, or, you know, in a hut in the woods. It's, you know, it's about being at the centre and being, you know, made to feel, you know, that the people around you really care.
So powerfully said, Millie, and so articulately said. And also, listening to what you're saying, what I'm really feeling is yes, yes, yes for birth, 100%. And then there's also this massive kind of drop off a cliff that women go through once they've had their babies, and then their postnatal mums. I feel that everything you just spoke to about birth almost needs to continue for that postnatal period, that women mothers feel at the centre of the decision making and that experience. And I think there's a huge getting left by the wayside that happens postnatally.
Absolutely. I mean, and if we could have, you know, if the positive birth movement could have done, you know, postnatal groups, if that could have been possible, and I was already too overstretched as it was. But, you know, there's a huge need for that sort of thing. I think there is more now than when I was, you know, when I was first a mum, my eldest is 13, I felt so isolated. And I think now that we've got, you know, more social media and stuff like that, there are, you know, apps and different sort of mum meetup kind of things, which I would have absolutely, in fact, I even had the idea for it when I had my first baby. I was like, if only there was some way of like finding other mums in the area. And at the time it just didn't exist, apart from going to the toddler group, which was really hit and miss, you know, because sometimes you'd meet someone there who I've got friends from those toddler group days now that I'm still friends with, but other people who are just like, when they were really nice, but they just weren't my people, you know. So it's really hard to find, you know, people who've got babies and kids the same age as you, who you've also got something in common with, especially when you live rurally like I do. It's really difficult. But yeah, that whole postnatal thing, you know, women just aren't cherished enough in that time, are they? It's either, you know, they either feel ignored, or they feel like they're under pressure to sort of get their body back, or go back to work, or, you know, it's not enough love is poured onto them at that time, I don't think.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think I've noticed as well that kind of wave over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. My son's nearly 15. So like you, when I had him, it was a time of huge isolation and there wasn't much on offer. And now it feels like there's a huge tidal wave in this movement around empowering women throughout pregnancy and motherhood, which feels pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I mean, social media is a bit of a nightmare. We all agree that, you know, we probably waste too much time on it, and it can be quite destructive, and there's loads of like unusual takes on reality that occur on it, etc. But in, you know, in the sense of connecting people, I think it's been absolutely brilliant, and especially for women, because it's given women a platform, you know, to talk about their life experiences in a way that I think it's unprecedented, really. You know, the way that women are kind of like, you know, talking about really taboo topics that have just been so brushed under the carpet for such a long time. Like, you know, for example, women's health, you know, that's such a sort of booming topic at the moment, of like, you know, how women's voices aren't listened to by doctors, and, you know, things like big topics like endometriosis and women's pain and misdiagnosis and chronic illness and all of those things. And suddenly all things like miscarriage, baby loss, you know, topics that were, you know, for our mum's generation were just so off everybody's radar and never got talked about, suddenly there's a whole, you know, hub of conversation around them. And it's just, I think that's just brilliant.
So let's have a little chat about Give Birth Like a Feminist. I think I can already hear some of your motivations in that, and I've absolutely loved the book. what drew you to going down that path? And it packs such a powerful punch.
Well, I mean, I just feel like the luckiest person in the world, really, that I got to write that book, because, you know, it's that book sums up kind of like why I was involved in the conversation in the first place, really. When I was first pregnant, I was really shocked by how sort of infantilized I sometimes felt, how sort of paternalistic the system was, how much of a power imbalance there was in the system. And it's suddenly, like I was saying earlier, you know, it's sometimes that you have to be pregnant to kind of have this on stuff on your radar, but it suddenly all came up on my radar and I was like, oh my God, this is just, no, why is no one talking about this? This is just really, really weird that we, you know, up until this point in my life, I'd kind of felt like I'm liberated. I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You know, I can make my own decisions. I can, you know, I'm a free woman. I can have my bank account. I can have my career. Yeah. But suddenly in birth, I just felt like I'd gone back in time or something. So I'd always had that passion. And obviously then I wrote the Positive Birth book. And because the Positive Birth book was successful, I got a wonderful agent. And when I went to my first meeting with her, she said, oh, tell me about your other ideas, you know, for the next book kind of thing. So I kind of had my little list, and right down the bottom, I'd written, you know, birth and feminism, maybe called Give Birth Like a Feminist or whatever, and I sort of saved it to last, because I just thought, no one's going to think this is a good idea apart from me. This is just, you know, it's a bit too niche, you know, this is like a proper literary agent in London. And anyway, we had our chat, and at the end of the chat she said, and I think that's the one, the feminism one, that's the one I want you to go away and think more about. So I was like, okay. So then the next step for that, in that process in writing world, is that you write a book proposal. And then that gets sent out to lots of publishers by the agent. And then you sort of have to sit and wait and see. It's a bit like sending out a job application sort of thing. You just have to wait and see what comes back. So I was thinking, well, it's great that this lovely agent likes this idea, but I don't know whether that anyone, you know, in their right mind is actually going to want to publish this book, like proper, you know, publishers. And anyway, it took ages. It was like a really long way. But in the end, two big publishers were interested in it, so I was wrong about that, and I ended up going with HarperCollins, which was just an incredible experience for me. It was so exciting, and they are absolutely brilliant, the publishers that I went with. The team is called HQ Stories, and they're part of HarperCollins, and they got it all. And like I said, the person whose desk the proposal landed on was actually in the very early stages of pregnancy. So she was like, oh, this is interesting, you know, in a new thought way. So yeah, that's how I ended up writing that book. And yeah, it just brought everything together for me, really. It allowed me to write about why I was so passionate about this topic in a way.
What did you learn while you were writing Give Birth Like a Feminist? What did you know before, and how did you feel afterwards?
Well, it was a really interesting process. I think writing a book's just a fantastic process, really, for anyone in any topic. It's a bit like going on a course, because, you know, except it's all self-led. So you have to do a lot of reading and researching. And yeah, it was great to sort of go deeper into lots of areas. You know, there was a whole chapter, as you know, about the history of birth. And that was really fascinating to read more about and research more about. And, you know, some of the stuff around, you know, women's bodies and whether or not they work, in inverted commas, was really interesting to learn more about, you know, the obstetric dilemma, you know, this idea that, you know, birth is more difficult for people because we've evolved to walk upright and our pelvises are too narrow and for the baby to get out and all that kind of thing. Which is just one of those things that people will tell you when you're pregnant. Oh yeah, you know, that's just how it is. It's true. But, you know, researching that discovered that actually that's only a theory, and that theory has been challenged. And, you know, it's also quite possible that we have evolved perfectly to birth our babies. And that, you know, it's just really interesting to explore areas like that and, you know, just think about more about the narratives and, you know, what we're told versus what might be true. And just, yeah, I just really enjoyed writing it. But it was very, very hard as well. When I say enjoyed, I mean in a kind of like lying on the floor crying kind of enjoyment.
how does it feel when you finish that book and you kind of go, the end? You know, what kind of feeling do you get when you email it back to the publisher and go, I'm done?
Brief period of elation followed by massive anxiety crisis, usually. Yeah, because, you know, it's like, it's really weird. It's, I've spoken to other writers about this and they all agree it's quite similar that, you know, you think you're going to feel brilliant when it's finished. It's the same if you've ever done a big course, like, an essay-based thing or something like that. You know, to begin with, you feel great, but then you do worry because you think, well, is it done? You know, you start to sort of have the sort of existential kind of like crisis about it and think, well, what, you know, you lie awake at night and think, did I really do justice on page 73? Did I forget who was that woman I was talking to? And did I put that bit in? And you just start worrying, basically. How is it going to be received? What's the editor going to think? What's the wider world going to think? And I'm now going through that with my next book, sort of thinking, yay, it's coming out, and then what will everyone think of it, sort of thing.
Well we're excited already. We're really looking forward to reading it. Going back to Give Birth Like a Feminist, like, positive birth is not just a particular set of circumstances. Traumatic birth similarly takes all shapes and forms, and lots of women who have difficult or traumatic birth experiences sometimes blame themselves for their own high expectations around giving birth. And as a result, the narrative that it all goes out the window continues. Do you think we can educate people about their choices without making them fearful of medical assistance or letting go when things don't follow the plan?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. I mean, the point you raised is about, trauma, and just going back to, you know, what we were saying earlier about why I wrote the book. I think that's another thing that massively motivated me, you know, as a feminist, is seeing how many women in my life and, you know, from people that I knew well to sort of people I met at the toddler groups, you know, who I, you know, didn't know that well, how many women I spoke to had traumatic births, or not just really traumatic, like suffering from PTSD kind of births, but just pretty awful births. And I think that really annoyed me, and it still annoys me. That's still the kind of main thing that drives me when I hear people's birth stories and they are so upset and traumatized by them. I just think this cannot be right, that all of these women are having this awful life experience and they're just expected to just suck it up and get on with it. And the fact that I think from a personal point of view, through going through birth twice by the time I was sort of writing about all this stuff, you know, I discovered for myself that it is possible to have a different type of experience. I had to prove that to myself, really. My second birth was really, really beautiful, beautiful birth. And I didn't believe that was possible really deep down until I'd done it myself.
These things are the underlying things that motivate us and make us so passionate, because we know what an impact it can have on ourselves and the people we love.
Yeah. And in a way, it's like, it's also the lack of impact that it has. I think that's what struck me the most about the second birth experience I had was, you know, I mean, it's lovely to talk about, oh, it's so transformative and it makes you feel so empowered and strong and everything. And yeah, that's true. But in a way, the great thing about that, having a straightforward, brilliant, positive birth experience, was that it didn't have any impact on me. I felt great, you know, and I just got on with the next day and the next week and the next month. I didn't have everything that I had after my first birth in terms of like feeling quite shell-shocked and emotionally jangled, plus, you know, I'd had an episiotomy and I had, you know, it didn't heal very well and I had lots of physical problems, you know, and I was sore and bruised in emotionally and physically for a long time after that birth, and it took a lot of getting over. And I'm by no means do I ever go around saying, oh, I had this really awful traumatic first birth, because by a lot of people's standards and a lot of the stories I've heard, it was actually pretty good. But the second birth, it was like life just carried on as normal afterwards, you know. I felt fine. I just felt just as good as I had the day before I had the baby, really, except I felt even better because I didn't have a like 10-pound human trapped inside of me.
It's interesting, isn't it, though, because it's great that there's more and more conversation about birth trauma and what that means, and you know, well, there's lots of people in the birth space trying to work with women to help them have more empowered experiences and more positive experiences. And then also there's still this whole conversation, I hear it in my classes, where someone has had a more positive birth experience, it's just been more straightforward, it's been less interrupted in their whole life, like you say, they could just get on the next day. And a lot of those women are actually feeling quite silenced, that they can't talk about their positive birth because it might upset someone who's had a less positive birth. We're in this sort of tricky space where we want to hear everyone's stories and everyone needs to be seen and heard and acknowledged. But yet there's, we quite haven't nailed the balance, have we?
No, no, it is difficult. Women feel silenced on both sides, don't they, really? Yeah, it's difficult to tell your difficult birth story because you don't want to. And that goes back to your question as well about, you know, how do we prepare women for birth? If we talk about positive birth too much, are we setting women up to fail? Are we saying, yeah, you know, you can have this really amazing birth experience, blah, 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 and then they don't and they, you know, blame us or feel disappointed? What is really good birth preparation? What does it entail? I was talking to this woman the other day who's written this book called Afterbirth, and she's called Jessica Hatchamore. A lot of it is about healing from difficult birth, you know, about postnatal recovery. You know, she was sort of saying how much of that is okay to talk about to pregnant women. And I'm sure you have these questions as well. Like, do you talk about tearing, you know, or other kind of like complications that can happen? Because pregnant women are very often already terrified, aren't they? So what is good birth preparation? And on the other hand, you know, do you lay on thick about how inspiring and life-changing and fantastic birth can be, because are you then setting women up to fail?
Yeah, I think I definitely discovered that during kind of my first year of teaching pregnancy yoga, like back 15 years ago. I was kind of really passionate that yes, it is possible and these tools can really help you. And then after about a year, I kind of was like, do you know what? There's lots of women coming back to the classes that just didn't happen. You know, there's lots of people that had a really tricky time. And I found we were doing a lot of mopping up in the postnatal classes and helping people process their big experiences. And then it sort of reframed our whole kind of Lush Tums approach into kind of acknowledging that everything has a place. We might not quite understand it in the moment, but everyone's experience is going to be their unique story, however it unfolds, and having to be a much bigger container for, in inverted commas, positive and negative experiences. But yeah, it took a lot of learning in the very early days to kind of get to that point.
Yeah, and I think as well, there isn't a one size fits all approach, is there? You know, going back to my books, Give Birth Like a Feminist, I get loads of messages from people who read that book. And obviously I read all the Amazon reviews and that kind of stuff. So it's because it's really interesting as a writer to see that feedback. And a lot of people just say, oh my God, you know, I read this book when I was pregnant and it just completely galvanized me. It just made me feel so outraged and so strong and so like I had all these rights and I could ask questions and it was fantastic. I think, great. And then occasionally, again, and it is a minority, but I do read feedback from people who say, you know, it really upset me. I couldn't read it because I was pregnant and it terrified me. And you know, one or two people have even said, how is this even a book for pregnant women? So you've got, you know, 100 pregnant women and five of those pregnant women reading that book, or I don't know the exact numbers, but just going by the reviews, you know, a small number of them will find it terrifying. It's too much. Whereas other people will find it the best thing that ever happened to them in their pregnancy. So you can't create, presumably, an antenatal course that, you know, is just a blanket approach. I guess, you know, you have to read the room, don't you, if you're in a group of pregnant women and you're talking.
Completely. Just responding to where they're at and their experiences to that point, you know, what they're coming with.
And I like how, you know, you set it out very clearly. And I actually did this for my first birth as well, quite naturally. I had a plan A, a plan B and a plan C, because that's the type of person that I am. And once I'd done my antenatal education classes, I was like, well, sometimes it's like this. And if this happens, this is what I'd like. and sometimes it's like this, and if this happens, this is what I'd like. And sometimes it's like this, and you're having a cesarean, and this is what I'd like to happen. And you describe that as sort of plan A, plan B, plan C when making your birth preferences or you're making your birth plan. And I really like how that it then just shifts the onus onto, instead of having one set of circumstances where you feel empowered to make choices, actually you're empowered in all circumstances and you have choice and agency in all scenarios.
No, it's a good point. I mean, I think that the current birth system is very infantilizing, you know, to women. And women, the system behaves as parents, and women naturally fall into the role of child if they're not careful. And I'm talking about the underlying dynamics. I don't mean that people are literally behaving like parents and children, but it's the dynamics of the interactions. And in that dynamic, you know, if you bring in an idea like a birth plan, it's bound to already be sort of doomed before it gets started, because, you know, it's, you know, if a woman isn't being in the role of adult and decision maker and thinker and reader and question asker and just, you know, key person, then I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I think that the sort of idea of a birth plan being very rigid and fixed is quite a sort of childlike idea in a way, isn't it? It's kind of like, I want this, I want, you know, I can tell you from experience having, you know, kids in the house that, you know, sometimes it becomes like that, especially, you know, younger children, doesn't it? Of sort of, these are my demands kind of thing. So I think it's important that we encourage, you know, people not to just abandon the idea of the birth plan, but to think of it as much more of a kind of adult document, which is, you know, to do with, you know, which explores what they want in different situations. And it's not just a, you know, a demand. It's got flow in it, you know, and it's got, you know, if you like the plan A, plan B, plan C, it incorporates different scenarios and different thoughts that they've had about what they might want in different situations. But it's a shame that the birth plan gets this sort of bad press. And again, it's quite polarizing, isn't it? It's like, either you make this really rigid plan and you laminate it, or you just don't bother and you just go with the flow.
And actually, I think that middle ground of having plan A, plan B, plan C, maybe even plan D, and understanding what all the terms are within those different scenarios, what are the pros and cons if you're offered, say, forceps, you know, have you weighed up what the possible outcomes might be for further down the line with, say, prolapse? And would that necessarily maybe change your mind as to, you know, accepting that? Or perhaps that might be a point where some women might just go, actually, no, I'd just rather have a cesarean, thanks. So it's important to have lots of information and lots of stats and understand terminology for all the plans, so that when things start to weave amongst them, women can still make their own decisions.
Yeah. And I mean, as a starting point, quite often, unfortunately, as I'm sure you know as well from your work, is that some women don't even realise that they have choices. So it's not about learning about, oh, if you get offered forceps, you can think about this, this and this. It's more like basic than that. It's just literally, you know, the power dynamic is sometimes so strongly weighted against the woman that she doesn't even realise that she has a voice in the process at all, and that she can ask for something different to happen, or take 10 minutes to weigh something up, or change midwives, or, you know.
And we really see that with the language. I know you're obviously very interested, and you have a huge love of language, given your career as a writer, but we hear that in the bathroom when women will recount their stories, and they'll use language like, they allowed me to do this, they said they'd let me do that. And it's always around that language that we try and educate people, that if they kind of hear that, can they then reframe that exact sentence and take back their ownership in that moment? And it's a good tool for birth partners to listen for those kinds of words and instantly reframe it. So they've said, will allow you to go another hour, but actually, how are you feeling? Do you think you can go another hour? And actually reframe it in the moment as a question for her.
Yeah.
So in that second, and she can respond with her choice.
Absolutely. Yeah, that language of permission, as I sometimes call it, is everywhere. And that was another one of the things that really put my feminist hackles up very early on in my own pregnancy experiences, is the sort of like idea of being allowed or not allowed. And, you know, they let me, like after my first baby, you know, I went to, I am a slow cooker. So all of my three babies have been late, in inverted commas. And my first baby, I had her at 42 plus 4. So I was induced at 42 plus 3. And I really noticed that, you know, when I told my birth story to people, that was just their only takeaway. I was like, I would tell this amazing story. And they were like, what? 42? I didn't know they let you go that long. And they'd always say, I didn't think they let you do that. They'd say, well, they didn't let me go that long or whatever. It's so annoying. You make the decisions about what happens to your body.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We suddenly become pregnant or preparing for birth and that language becomes so normalised. You hear it in coffee shops, people talking about being let or being allowed. And it's something we try and address and reframe in our pregnancy yoga classes when people come out with little statements like that, even in pregnancy, just to challenge it a little bit and go, have a think about that. Have a think about that language.
It is across, you know, life, and you know, I've noticed it a lot in healthcare as well, outside of pregnancy too, though, this lack of understanding of bodily autonomy and consent. I've noticed it with my kids, you know, with doctors, quite often they say, oh, I'm just going to do this now, and you know, they don't ask permission, they don't respect body boundaries, and I don't think most of them, you know, that they don't come from a bad place. You know, I think it's just ingrained that's how it's done. And I've had some dentistry experiences recently as well, which have been very similar, and you think, God, you didn't even ask me if it was okay that you did that, you know, you just went ahead with it, you know. It's
and what's even your name? You haven't even introduced yourself.
Yeah, well, there was a big campaign, wasn't there, you know, hello, my name is. And you know, that's really important that that medical professionals start with that sentence. And it's interesting, if you sit, I mean, I was in children's ward about 6 months ago with my daughter and we were there for a couple of nights because she had suspected appendicitis, and so I saw a lot of different doctors and nurses coming and going, and some of them have read the hello, my name is kind of stuff, and they come in and they really, you know, try and make that connection, and it makes such a difference.
And it sets a tone as well, you know, if children are treated with that kind of respect as children, they're going to grow up to be much more empowered adults. So when they do reach the birth room themselves, if we're talking about women, they're already going to have an awareness of the power of that language. We're hopefully going to ingrain a new pattern.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really, really vital that, you know, we talk to our children about things like body boundaries and consent. And I think it's difficult because, you know, obviously, and I can see parents wrestling with this, and I don't know how you manage it, but, you know, you do have to have some authority as a parent. And you also, I think it helps children to feel safe if they know that there's an adult in the room, if you like, and it's that, you know, if you completely give children, this is just my personal view, and I know people would disagree with this, but I think it's a fine line that you tread as a parent, because I think if you give children all the authority and power and say, you know, well, this lady wants to give you an injection now, would you like to have an injection, you know, and then they have to make that decision when they're only, say, 9 or something, then I think that can be too much. And so it's about finding that fine line between teaching them about their autonomy and their consent, you know, and consent and body boundaries, but also allowing them to feel that you are the person in charge, not them. Because I think it can be quite frightening to be put in charge when you're very little.
Yeah, of course. It's quite a balancing act. So I love hearing about your birth story, a bit of your birth story about going 42 plus 3 days. That's so cool. I'm really, really inspired by that. What do you think about the kind of, you know, free birth movement, which is like a different thing again?
Well, I think, I mean, first of all, it wasn't cool going to 42 in 3 days, to be honest with you. It was really, really awful. And it was obviously my first baby, and you know, I went through the whole, you know, you need to be induced thing from quite early on and all those conversations. And, you know, it was really stressful, and I was induced in the end. But anyway, that is another story really. But free birth, you know, well, I think as I've said in Give Birth Like a Feminist, that we have to support all choices. We have to trust women. And, you know, we can't just pick and choose which choices we will support and which choices we won't support. If we truly trust women, we have to say, I support you, even if we wouldn't make that choice for ourselves. And I definitely wouldn't have a free birth, but that's just me. And I'm not judging anybody who does have a free birth. It's just personal choice. And I completely understand why women would want to do it. And I know that the women who do it have their own best interests and their baby's best interests at heart, and they've done their homework and they know what they're doing. So yeah, it wouldn't be for me, but I would 100% not judge, or, you know, any woman who made that choice for herself, because that's what we've got to do if we want to support women to make their own decisions as adults and be respected and trusted. Then we have to support them in choices that we wouldn't make, and that even in choices that we don't think are right or safe, we have to support that woman to have the right to make that choice, the freedom.
Absolutely.
So brilliantly said. Thank you. You've given me goosebumps listening to you.
It shouldn't be an individual's choice over someone else's, should it? Everything should be on the table. If we start to take one thing off the table, who's to say we don't start taking other things off the table?
Well, exactly. And you can see, you only have to look around the world, or, you know, through history, to see scenarios of that being the case. It's a slippery slope.
And then I start thinking about Margaret Atwood novels and getting really freaked out.
Exactly. Well, that's the quote, isn't it? You know, the bathwater slowly increasing in temperature until, you know, till it's boiling and you're not noticing until it's too late. I think that's, you know, you have to always be a bit vigilant for the erosion of rights, even in areas that don't necessarily affect us personally, because they will eventually affect us personally, even if they don't at the moment.
Do you feel that since you wrote those two books, things have moved on in terms of women-centred care, or in terms of changing the system so that idea around consent is perhaps becoming more talked about? Do you feel like things have moved in a positive direction, if you like, or do you feel as though the battle is just the same as when you wrote the books?
Well, I don't know. It swings and roundabouts, I think. I mean, you can't make a sort of sweeping generalisation. So, I mean, I think lots has changed for the better. I think, as we were saying earlier, you know, social media and women, A, being able to connect with each other better, being able to organise, being able to come together, find ways of connecting, but also tell their stories and raise awareness of issues which have previously been swept under the carpet, all of that. And also just sharing like birth films and videos, which is just incredibly, I mean, it's so rich now, isn't it, on Instagram. You know, there's millions of fantastic, inspiring birth films that you can watch. Whereas when I was pregnant for the first time, it was really much harder to see films like that. And now they're everywhere and they really help. So I think, you know, obviously my books, other books that have come out, other, you know, it's not just me, you know, there's other people like you and, you know, lots of other people who are sort of changing the narrative, changing the conversation. All of that really is helping. And I definitely get lots of messages from women who feel that they have had a, you know, a better birth as a result of, you know, reading my books. But I'm not just trying to like big myself up. I mean, reading my books within the context of a new landscape, which has sort of happened in the last decade or so. So I think there's lots to be positive about. And also clinicians, I think, you know, like, and healthcare professionals are many of them are listening and are trying to make positive changes. But on the other hand, there are still you know, an awful lot of women having shit births. And I hear from them too. And there is, you know, a real lack of understanding of what women need in birth that still, I think, pervades a lot of the maternity care system. And, you know, a really good point, I think, that was made to me recently about the pandemic, which I'm going to steal, is that it's, you know, a friend of mine called Charlotte Eden, who's a doula, said it to me, and I think it's such a good point, and I'm going to steal it, is that the what happened in the pandemic is that we went down to what was considered to be essential. So maternity care was pared down in the name of, you know, safety because of COVID and everything. We pared it down to what the system considered to be essential, and that was very revealing. And I think that's a really interesting thought, because, you know, when you think about, you know, what was taken out in order to sort of pare down and minimalize, you know, birth to make it safer from the point of view of COVID, a lot of what was taken out was the kind of nice fluffy extras, if you like. Or what are considered to be the nice fluffy extras, because they're not considered to be essential.
Yeah.
So things like a doula, the support of your partner, and in some cases, unfortunately, even some bodily autonomy was taken away. For example, we need to know how dilated you are before you can be admitted, so you have to have a vaginal exam because of COVID. So, you know, birth was kind of pared down, and what that then does is it reveals to us what the maternity care system does not consider to be essential to women. And that's the point that Charlotte made to me, which I thought, yeah, that's really true. You know, it's really revealing. And I think that we've got that all wrong. Birth has got such a long way from how it should be in order for it to be a really fantastic experience for a woman. And also to proceed, you know, just from a physiological point of view, you know, to make oxytocin and for birth to sort of have the best possible chance of flowing and proceeding as it should. You know, we're still not putting women in environments and in, you know, surrounding them with the kind of atmosphere that they need to produce oxytocin. It's dead, you know, it's so simple. It's not even about anything complicated. It's just that bare essential.
Well, absolutely. And feeling safe is such a key thing to allow the birthing process to happen. If people are feeling fearful and that adrenaline's going, it makes everything else that much more difficult. I wonder if at the end of Give Birth Like a Feminist, you actually make a little plea to the policymakers out there, and you speak to those that are in power, if you like. And from our work over the last few years, we have sometimes seen what sounds like fantastic announcements. For example, the recommendation that having continuity of carer leads to considerably better outcomes for mum and for baby. And it appeared that the health secretary was going to make that part of policy, and that going forward that was going to be happening. However, we all know the last few years has maybe interrupted that. And with policies like that that seem as though they're going to have a really positive impact on everything, you know, to be then counteracted with the latest suggestion of the amendment of the NICE guidelines regarding bringing induction forward to 41 weeks. It feels like sometimes there's this push and pull going on, and that your plea to those policymakers is still very relevant. Wondering how on the ground these changes are really going to affect women and really affect things going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately, you know, like I just said about, you know, paring down birth to what people consider to be essential, I think unfortunately there is still this pervading belief, you know, this idea that all that matters is a healthy baby. And that kind of philosophy that it doesn't really matter what the birth goes like, how the woman feels, how the baby gets out, as long as everyone's sort of alive at the end of it, then that's a good outcome. I mean, that's and obviously I always have to be very careful to say that I'm not suggesting for a second that that we should compromise safety, and that obviously everyone being alive at the end of it is really important, but that should be the baseline of our expectations, not the pinnacle of our expectations. You know, and I've had run-ins over the years with various birth safety campaigners who I think have done, in some ways without wishing to, they've done a lot of damage, because they have pushed the all that matters is a healthy baby, you know, narrative and agenda so far, you know, and it's been very pervasive in press articles and in, you know, in the media narrative as well, you know, that the idea that midwives are compromising safety, for example, in a quest for, you know, natural birth, and all of that narrative, which is totally at odds with what I expect you see in terms of what happens to the women that you come into contact with, and it's certainly at odds with many of the stories that women send to me about their birth experiences. You know, this idea that there's a natural birth agenda makes me laugh, because it's like, well, go and get a natural birth then. If you think you can get this a natural birth agenda, it's not very effective.
You just have to see the statistics around cesareans and intervention and spontaneous labour to know that, you know, the majority are still not getting that experience. And then I do think it's interesting that there, when it comes to implementing a policy that is about adding more medical intervention, it seems to be taken very quickly and seems to be given priority. And yet something like the continuity of carer, which, you know, had such statistical support in the health and safety of the mum and the baby, and yet somehow that's not given priority. It's almost like we're designed to find the thing that is quantifiable. You know, I always think of that Monty Python scene with, and look, here's the machine that goes ping, aren't you lucky? It's like there's a patriarchal sense of security around finding ways to measure something, which Mark Harris in our podcast described it as immeasurable. And yet that's, you know, part of our society is, you know, we are probably scientifically more minded than we used to be. You talk about kind of the life affirming or the life changing nature of birth, and perhaps the psycho spiritual side of it. And that is almost not given even a slight platform to speak. And yet it's part of our human experience.
Yeah, but it's really odd as well, isn't it? You know, I know what you're saying is absolutely true, that people like to have like hard, you know, they like to hear the machine go ping or see the sort of, you know, the solid facts and figures. But, you know, if you look at, and I wrote about them in Give Birth Like a Feminist, you know, some of the models of care that are woman-centred and that are what I call hands-off models of care, you know, where the midwife is in the background unless needed, and the woman does the birthing, and, you know, and as a result usually feels really flipping brilliant afterwards because she did it. Those sorts of models of care, which are you know, they do have fantastic stats. You know, one-to-one midwives, who are, when I was writing Give Birth Like a Feminist, were still up and running. And I spoke to Maureen, I think it is, from One-to-One Midwives, and she's quoted in the book. Well, since the book was published, they've been they don't exist anymore. And she sort of foretold that in the book. She knew that was coming. She talked to me about how they were up against it constantly, and, you know, always being asked, you know, does the woman have capacity, for example, if a woman was making choices out of guidelines, and having midwives, you know, reported to the NMC, etc. So these midwives who are, I've got a whole chapter in the book called Loose Women, you know, and it's kind of about women who won't do what they're told, women who won't comply, whether that be women who are, you know, pregnant women or midwives, you know, or birth workers, you know, and how the world treats women who won't toe the line, really. And these, we do have the evidence to show how helpful and powerful that model of midwifery can be, in terms of outcomes, you know, and who gets out of it alive, etc. But that doesn't seem to be enough. People are still suspicious of it. and it still very often gets shut down.
And maybe that suspicion is a suspicion of women's innate power and capacity.
Yeah, women as the decision makers. I think that's true. You know, and I've write about it. I've talked about this before with the positive birth movement. You know, on a few occasions, you know, people say to me, "Oh, okay, so what is the positive birth movement?" So I say, "Well, it's like antenatal groups. You know, women just come together, talk to other women, listen to other women, listen to birth stories." And so that, you know, they'd say, "Well, yeah, but who's the teacher?" And I say, "Well, it's not really a teacher. It's just a discussion group. You know, people just talking to each other. You know, there's someone there who sort of puts the kettle on, but they don't. No one gets taught anything. They're like, so, and people say, "Oh, is that safe?" You know. This idea that women just being in a room together talking about childbirth without an expert to tell them what to do or to guide them was somehow, you know, subversive in a way. And I think that's quite revealing that, you know, on a few occasions people sort of said, "Oh, how does that really work then? You know, is that actually safe?"
Imagine a group of men coming together to talk about the Euro, like, "Oh, is that safe? Are they allowed to discuss the football? Who's the referee?"
But you get a group of women together in a circle talking about these really informative life stages that we go through, and it's a powerful experience. It's a powerful to participate in. It's an incredible thing to witness. There's a lot of healing and processing and learning and knowledge share that goes on, and that is another big part of why we offer our classes, to create those spaces where women can sit with other women and just share and reflect and be heard, seen and acknowledged. I think it's immeasurably powerful.
And yet we cannot measure it. We cannot quantify it. We cannot do a chart of satisfaction. When I entered this meeting, I felt about 5. And now I've left, I'm about a 9. Maybe that's what we should do. Maybe that's how things will get changed.
Satisfaction is a crap word anyway, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, maternal satisfaction.
It's like a chocolate biscuit and a cup of tea when the kids are in bed. That's my maternal satisfaction.
So this is kind of bringing me back round, you know, all of this amazing conversation, Millie, is just now making me think about my daughter. She's nearly 11. I'm so going to be getting her your new book. And it's about, for me now, really educating her as to, and also my son as well, educating him about women's autonomy and empowerment. And I think that's where the story has to start, you know, their first rite of passage, you know, starting their periods and their body changing and what that means to become a woman. What was your motivation for writing this book, and where do you see it making a change?
Well, I was lucky enough a few years ago, it's 2017, to be asked to go to Sydney. How exciting. Can you imagine how exciting that was for me? So I went. I was only there for a few days because my children were even littler then, so I couldn't leave them for very long. So I went all the way to Australia for about 5 nights, I think it was, or 6 nights, and then came back to the home birth conference in Sydney. And it was the most fantastic conference I think I've ever been to, not just because I got to go to Sydney, but just because the Australian home birth midwives, I don't know if you've seen the film Birth Time that's just come out. Well, it was all that crew who organised the conference and who I was, you know, being hosted by and everything. And they are absolutely brilliant women. They're so much fun, so bright, so intelligent, so on the ball. And it was absolutely just one of the highlights of the last few years for me. But anyway, one of the women who I met when I was in Australia was a woman called Jane Hardwick Collings. You can follow her on Instagram, Facebook, and she has a really lovely mailing list as well. And she runs something in Australia called the School of Shamanic Womancraft, which sounds quite wacky. But, you know, if anyone's put off by that kind of level of wackiness, please don't be, because she's just so down to earth. I'm not put off by it, by the way, but I know some people might think, "Oh, that sounds kind of weird." Yeah, I mean, she had the conference was drummed in by this circle of drummers, and at the end they had a lovely ritual as well to end the conference, and all of that kind of stuff. Just amazing. She's absolutely fantastic, Jane is. And she came over to the UK and did a workshop. She does these wonderful workshops on sort of women's mysteries and rites of passage. And she, because she came and did one in Glastonbury, I live in Somerset, about half an hour from Glastonbury. So she invited me when she, after she'd met me at the conference, she was in the UK 6 months later or something, and asked me if I wanted to come. So I went to her workshop, which was all about menstruation. It was 2 days sitting in circle with lots of other really interesting women and Jane. And that really, really suddenly turned on a light bulb for me about the connections between, you know, these narratives that we're told as children and from, you know, from birth, really, about what it means to be a woman and, you know, what it, what women's power is all about and all of that kind of stuff. You know, she got me thinking, for example, about my first period and what I was told about my period, how it happened, how it was celebrated. And then going back, just thinking about your mum's relationship with her mum and what that might have been like and what they might have, and also about your own birth, how you were born, and also about your mum's relationship with your grandmother. And just looking back, in, as I said, kind of like spending a couple of days thinking about all of these things, it was really, really incredibly enlightening, I thought. And it drew for me the connection between, you know, my own feelings about my own body, my period, my birth expectations, my birth experiences. And it sort of showed me how these things pass through generations. And it was just so fascinating. So that's what got me thinking about, it suddenly made me realize, I mean, I suppose it should be obvious, obviously there's a link between menstruation and birth, but, you know, kind of a deeper than that, you know, like how there could be a link between how, our birth, our first periods are talked about and celebrated and how we're made to feel about them and how we, what we then take with us in, into the birth room in terms of our own confidence in our bodies, trust in our bodies, disgust with our bodies or lack of disgust with our bodies, our ability to be in our bodies, you know, what does that feel like, you know, to be, you know, to really go in, you know, what it's like when you're in labor and you really are, you know, it's, I think for some women that's, you know, for some of us, I'm not talking about other people, I'm talking about myself as well, there's something quite difficult about giving birth in terms of the fact that it is a very embodied experience, you know, and it is in some ways, some of it is, you know, there is some disgust, you know, a lot of women are like, what if I poo, you know, that's one of the big questions, isn't it, will I do a poo when I have a baby, and will I lose control? I don't know. I think it's all fascinating, the whole sort of picture of how all of these things link up and all of the shame that is around menstruation and the disgust that is around menstruation and the way it's not celebrated either, just like birth isn't really and postnatal isn't, like we talked about earlier. So all of those connections. So I had all that in my mind and I'm really grateful to Jane for all of, for getting me thinking about all of those things. And then obviously thinking about what book to do next, and my agent just said to me, this publisher's really interested in a book for, she knew that I was interested in periods, and she said to me, you know, this publisher wants to do a book on periods. So we just got chatting, and actually it was right in the beginning of the pandemic, so I was so grateful, because, you know, everything, like for all of us, had just been completely thrown up in the air, so to get a book deal at that point was really, really good. I was really grateful for it, but also lovely to do a children's book. It's been a really interesting process. You know, there's illustrations and it's, I've sent you some of the pages so you've seen how it's all been laid out really beautifully and it's all really good fun and there's loads of like graphic design and everything, and it's, yeah, it's been quite good fun seeing that all come together and being a part of that.
Oh, it looks absolutely brilliant. I can't wait to see a real copy in my hands and share it with my daughter.
Me too. Mine's only 7, so I might have to wait a couple of years, but I'm really looking forward to celebrating this milestone with her. I don't know about you guys, but all I had was, are you there, God, it's me, Margaret. It's a great book, isn't it? But I have to say, things like the sanitary protection in it is completely different now. I was very confused by what she was talking about. But I loved the idea that this was something, an event she was really looking forward to and her friends were going through it. And it did feel like a positive way to approach menstruation, where a lot of our narrative might be, oh, are you on? Have you got PMS? Have you, you know... let's take some Feminax, and where's the hot water bottle, this kind of perhaps I don't think our society does ever see it as a good thing unless it's there to show you that you're not pregnant when you don't want to be, or, you know, not there when you do want to be.
Yeah, I think another thing as well that I really wasn't taught, and I don't think many kids are still taught, is about the kind of the whole menstrual cycle, you know, as opposed to just the period. So a lot of period education is very focused on, you know, once a month, you know, you're going to have this blood and it's going to last this number of days, and this is a tampon and this is a pad and this is, you know, and that's it kind of thing. So it's all focused around the period. And I it wasn't until I was in my 30s or even 40s that I started to get more, you know, wisdom, if you like, about the cycle as a whole. And I think, you know, that's been really helpful to me. You know, I can remember my friend saying to me when I was probably in my 30s, oh, I can tell when I'm ovulating. And I was like, what? Just hadn't ever occurred to me that I would be able to tell when I was ovulating, and that I could actually feel it. She said to me, I know which side I ovulate from because I can feel it. And I was like, I'd never really thought about it, but why would you? You know, if no one ever teaches you these things. I'm not saying that every woman can, you know, can do that, but it's probably, if you tune in a bit more, you might be able to. And, you know, what impact does it have on us, you know, this, the cycle, and how can we use that in our favour? And that's something that I've tried to make the period book for preteens focused on, is not just the period, but, you know, what's the cycle and what's ovulation? I mean, ovulation, I think, is great to know about, because a lot of women feel at the top of their game when they're ovulating. So it's really good to know that. That's useful information, and it might not apply to you, but it's useful to think about, how do I feel during all these different times of the month, and how does the cycle impact on me personally? And it's going to be different for everyone. And, you know, to think about charting your cycle. And also, you know, the other thing that I think is really useful that I've learned, not from school period education, is, you know, how it can be a real sort of indicator of your overall health.
I've just heard it called the fifth vital sign.
Yeah. And no one teaches you these things when you're, well, I was never taught those things. And I don't think, I've sat in on a talk about my daughter's, this week she's having a, you know, periods and sex and everything day at school where they're going to do loads of stuff about it. And they told us all, they showed us all the resources. And they were all just as predictable as you would expect, really. I'm not necessarily criticising them, but there wasn't much going on there other than the basic stuff about, you know, pads and tampons and bleeding, and, you know, there was no talk of cycles, for example, or any of that stuff.
A bit like you, I've just been very much discovering cycles just in the last couple of years, you know, in my early 40s. And it's like, God, I wish someone had taught me this 25 years ago when I first started my period. I would have known a lot more about myself week to week, month to month. And I've got a question for you, actually, Millie. You know, if you could imagine a world where we all understood about women's menstrual cycles and how we feel week to week, month to month, do you think it could really change our landscape, say, how we deal with our employers or our employees, or how we deal with each other in relationships, or just in the family home, if we were all more cycle aware and could kind of say to each other, yeah, I'm in my summer, I'm feeling great at the moment, or actually I'm coming into my winter, I'm going to have a couple of days off. How do you think that might change society as a whole?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. There was going to be a bit in the book about menstrual leave, which in the end I think got cut out. And that's, it's an interesting thing to consider, you know, and I think these times that we're living in are quite interesting in terms of, you know, this conversation around, you know, what's different about being a woman can be quite complex at the moment and quite loaded. And it lands differently with different people. So for some people, the idea that, you know, we say, for example, menstrual leave is a good example. We introduce the idea that, you know, there might be a couple of days a month where women just feel they need to just, like you call it, winter, you know, they need to sort of hibernate and rest. Some people might see that as a really positive idea, you know, and that in other countries where they tried to implement this, they have had this sort of argument, if you like, that in you can frame it as a positive, like, oh, that's great, it's really woman-centered, it's really thinking about women's needs, it's encouraging women to think about their own needs, etc. But on the other hand, and in that sense, it's kind of feminist. But another another feminist way of looking at it is it's singling women out as somehow less capable than men because they have to have a couple of days a month off. You know, some women would say, I don't want to be positioned like that in the workplace as somebody who has a sort of special need because I'm female, if you like. So I think it's difficult.
But then there's other times of the month where you are, like you say, firing at the top of your game. So surely the 2 days chilling out, resting is going to help you have that energy for the middle part of your cycle. When I'm in that part of my cycle, I almost get like 3 days work done in one day. Like, you're so productive.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, yeah, so maybe we need to have like, you know, also bring in, you know, these kind of like hubs where ovulating women gather and, you know, change the world through, you know, through their sort of massive insights they get during that time. I don't know. But yeah, it is difficult, but I do think that definitely, you know, so there are complications that come with, you know, centering the cycle, you know, everything around the cycle. I think some people just would say, actually, no, I just want to get on with it, thanks. I don't really want to, you know, make a big thing out of it. And that's also a choice. I'm fine.
You know, some people don't ovulate or have periods for different reasons as well. So,
and just from a sort of biological point of view, though, I do think that there's always a value in knowing more about how your own body works. So just from a practical point of view, I think the idea of a different sort of teaching for young people around puberty and periods, for example, and teaching them about the cycle is, you know, it's not fair at the moment that people are essentially missing information about things like ovulation and, you know, how they might be affected by these different things. I think that, you know, any more information has got to be a good thing.
Wouldn't it be interesting, the point you raise about women perhaps not wanting to be treated as having a special need compared with their male counterparts in the workplace, and yet if we flipped it the other way around and imagine a woman-centred world where cycles were the norm and they were a part of life, and men could potentially benefit from finding their own periods of energy versus tiredness. A lot of our culture assumes that we're the same every single day, that we're coming into the workplace with the same level of mental health or physical wellness, and actually we know day by day we're all quite different creatures, men included, and wouldn't it be interesting to shift the perspective to well, how are you on this day? Is this a day where you would benefit from a less active physical practice? Or, you know, for example, if men, you know, not in the mood to keep their gym routine up that week and maybe need to have a more yoga week, you know, I just think it's a shame that the narrative starts with everyone has to be the same. There's no margin for the individual or for people's personal experiences.
That kind of reminds me of my daughter's school motto, which when I first saw it when she was going to primary school, I had to stand there and read it like 3 or 4 times for it to sink in. And it was really simple. It's, fair isn't that everyone gets the same. Fair is that everyone gets what they need.
Yeah, that's like that little graphic about the difference between equity and equality, isn't it? And equality is that everyone gets the same size box to stand on to look over the fence. Have you seen that cartoon?
No, I haven't seen that.
So it's like, I think there's like something on the other side of the fence that everyone's trying to see. I can't remember what the picture is, like a football game or something. And so there's like different height people and they've all got a box to stand on. So obviously the tall person stands on the box and they can see over the fence, but the shorter person can only just, and the very short person can't see over the fence. But and that's equality, everyone getting the same size box. But equity is everyone getting the size box that they need to see over the fence, basically.
Brilliant.
It's quite a good little cartoon. But yeah, I think what you're saying is, yeah, it's really interesting. And
one of the other questions we like to ask is, what are you grateful for in your life right now?
Well, I'm just grateful that, you know, I'm grateful that the kids are at school. If that doesn't sound too like bad mummy, but I am grateful that they're at school. I've actually really hated this whole pandemic experience, as I know everybody has, and everyone's had different experiences of it, and many much worse than mine. And I'm very grateful that I live in the countryside. That's been an absolute godsend over this past year. Although it was something that before the pandemic I was kind of slightly cursing, and I was thinking, oh, it's so boring living in a village, and I wish I had, you know, more stuff to do. And actually the last article that I wrote before the pandemic started was about rural life and how, you know, Londoners kind of glamorize it, but actually the reality of it can be a bit sort of slow and boring. But I soon changed my tune once the lockdown started, because, you know, seeing people struggling, I mean, how awful must it have been to be in a sort of city centre, you know, block of flats or something during this experience with kids. It would have been horrific. I mean, it was hard here, but, you know, I was so lucky to have fields around us and a garden and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, I'm really grateful for that, really. And I'm just grateful that, well, I'm grateful for the vaccine, and I'm grateful that things seem to be improving, although I'm utterly depressed by yesterday's news that we're not going to come out on June the 21st. And I'm hoping that things improve, because it's just so hard for people. And I am, you know, that's another thing I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for the Positive Birth book, and, you know, that it's still, you know, in terms of my income, you know, I've got some money coming from my writing, and it's not dependent on, you know, it isn't necessarily affected by the pandemic. You know, for people who are running nightclubs or, you know, bookshops or, you know, in trades, self-employed people who are, you know, have got businesses that are falling to bits because of the pandemic and who are having to borrow money, etc. I mean, it's just horrendous, and I really hope that the fallout from it in the next year or two isn't even worse than it is at the moment. I mean, I hope that we recover quickly. You know, I am really grateful to be where I am, really, in the countryside, self-employed in a business that of writing, which isn't dependent on the, you know, human contact.
Thank you. I definitely think you're not alone. I came to the conclusion that I am a much better part-time mummy than I am a full-time mummy. I need that time by myself to be the mum I want to be. And when you don't have a break and it is constant, I definitely didn't feel as if I was anything close to my best. Mm. Or I'm definitely with you on that. I was grateful for school was one of my first ones when we started this podcast. So I'm sure a lot of people will share that. And then you enjoy them so much more when you've had a little break and you've got different experiences you can talk to each other about, and you come and you reconnect. You know, that's lovely. You don't get that if you're all together all the time. We also believe that each of our babies brings us a gift. Maybe a quality in ourselves that we didn't have before, or a personality trait, or a perspective. Do you agree? And can you think of any gifts that your babies brought you?
Well, I think all three of them have brought so much to my life. I really feel quite emotional just thinking about it, really, because I love them so much and they're so amazing. And of course, if I put into this podcast any sort of strong statements about one or the other doing something special, then that'll haunt me for the rest of my life if they ever find it, because they'll accuse me of, you know, favouritism. Whatever I say, I'm doomed. Unless I say they all brought me this identical gift, which they didn't. but I guess, you know, well, so much, really. I mean, my first daughter taught me how to be a mum, like all first children do, and that was a really lovely time, the sort of first 2 years of sort of having her, and also taught me to sort of, you know, trust my judgment. You know, I was saying to my partner the other day, we were talking about people using slings and how so many people have their babies in slings now, but 13 years ago when my first daughter was born, especially living rurally, I was literally the only person using a sling, And people used to stop me in the street and ask me about it because they'd never seen one before. It was so unusual. So, and that was really hard, you know, making choices that were different to other people's and all of those sorts of things. It's, I think it's quite a learning curve, isn't it? So she kind of taught me to trust myself. And oh, she's such a fantastic person now. It's lovely being a mum to a teenager, although it's, you know, it's very different, isn't it, to 10 years ago. But yeah, it's so much. Middle daughter, I think, taught me that there's no room for sort of smugness or complacency in the parenting business. She's an absolute firecracker of a personality. And, you know, she's amazing. And that's what she taught me. I'll leave it at that. And I think, you know, third one, my little boy, Albie, this is a really funny thing that I think makes me sound slightly nuts, but I do think it was him that nudged me to being a writer. I don't know why it's makes me feel like a bit wacky to say that. But it was when I was pregnant with him that I made that sort of pitch to the Telegraph. And I really felt him sort of, I don't know, I can't really explain it, but I just felt like him sort of egging me on a bit. I can't wait till he's an adult so I can talk to him about that. But I felt like he really champions me, even though he's only 7. And he's sort of, I don't know, I sometimes wonder whether it was like being pregnant with a boy just gave me more sort of confidence. Would that be a weird thing to say too? Probably.
Not at all.
I would say when I had my first son, had a son and then a daughter, there was something even in the birth experience that shouted strength. And it just kind of soaked in. I just kind of got that via osmosis from him that I definitely didn't really have before. So I completely hear what you're saying and completely agree. And love to hear you put words to it. So thank you, Millie.
And I believe my daughter brought me creativity in a new way. So I wasn't creative the way I am now before she was born. So I really feel like she brought that with her.
That's lovely. I think being a mum as well, overall from all three of them, it brings you a lot more ambition, which I think is something that is not necessarily always put like that. I think people think, oh, it sort of ends careers and it sort of puts a stop to your dreams. But in some ways, which is also sometimes true, but I think it also makes you much more aware of the example you want to set to them of what being a, you know, being a woman and being a mum is, and kind of drag yourself up sometimes, even when you're really knackered and you sort of feel, you know, you're not good enough, or you're not coping, or you're not, you know, capable that particular day. It kind of makes you, their presence in your life makes you give yourself a kick up the arse and kind of keep going, because you want to be the best person you can be for them. Mm-hmm. Rather than just prior to motherhood, you're only really sort of thinking about yourself.
They're motivating, aren't they? They're like motivating forces in our lives, and I couldn't really put words to it either, but I definitely became way more productive, more efficient, more motivated, had more ideas after I had my children, and kind of had more of a focused direction on where I wanted to take my life. Like peripheral things that I might have tried to add in because that might have pleased other people, that just got swept away. It's a wheat from the chaff moment becoming a mum. And then it's like, okay, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm delivering. And there was no more room for other things that weren't so critical to my path. So yeah, they definitely brought a sort of motivating force to my endeavours.
Your time becomes so much more precious. You know, is this job worth me being away from my children? Is this how I want to spend my time? When I look back one day at this very brief window where my children are small, am I going to be pleased with the choices I made about how I was spending my time? And I don't think you can appreciate that till you have them.
100%. And that's actually why, you know, in a way, becoming a mum has got so many parallels. And I keep meaning to try and write something about this and not quite managing, but it's got so many parallels to the pandemic. You know, how everything gets turned upside down. Everything that you've already known to be true and the way things are, it gets thrown up in the air and you have to suddenly navigate this complete new territory. And also your freedom is suddenly restricted. And I'm sorry that I know that some people might find that the wrong thing to say, but I do think that is what happens when you have children. You can't just, you know, when they're really small, you literally, you know, you can sit on your sofa and think, oh, it's a really nice day. I wish I could go and buy some plants and plant them in that empty pot over there. But you're just literally underneath children. I mean, that's a silly example, but, you know, literally the tiniest ambition. It's not just to do with like, oh, maybe I'll go to New York this weekend. It's like, maybe I'll tidy that cupboard. You know, you just can't do it because they're all over you all the time. So you literally don't have the same freedom that you had before you were a parent. You can't just come and go as you please anymore, just in the same way as we were all finding, you know, when we were in the lockdown. And I think it is, you know, there are so many parallels there. And it does make you question your priorities and what's really important to you and use your time wisely.
That's the gift in it, is allowing your priorities and what's important to you to kind of bubble to the surface. You know, life gives you lemons. We've got to all make lemonade, you know.
Oh, you should definitely write that article, Millie. I think it same can be said for sort of mental health in terms of, you know, what we go into motherhood already with our experience and then the motherhood experience on top, and then how that might manifest for some people differently to others. And similar with the lockdown, you know, some people very quickly struggled with their mental health early on, and others perhaps it was a bit of a slow burner, or maybe people didn't struggle at all. Maybe people really enjoyed the new pace of life, but I felt like it was almost a magnifying glass on everything that was already there and bringing it all up to the forefront.
Any key messages you'd want to share for pregnant women coming up behind us? Any one piece of advice for teenage girls or kids having that start their periods?
Well, I suppose that the parallels there would be, you know, as I put in my book, you know, listen to your body, trust your body, love your body is the little phrase that reoccurs through the period book. And that's a pretty good mantra for women through life. Listen to your body, trust your body, love your body. But, you know, different messages for pregnant women. I always say, you know, don't believe what you're told that birth is potluck. That's my main piece of advice to pregnant women. Don't absorb that narrative because it's not true. You know, I think women are told it a lot. Oh, there's nothing that you can do to control it. So you just go turn up, go with the flow, blah, blah, blah. And the birth plans are pointless and it's all part of the same picture. So don't believe that. You know, you can make a difference by, you know, learning about your options and your choices and putting yourself in the driving seat. So that's my main piece of advice to pregnant women, really.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this has been the best. Thank you so, so much, Millie.